You're listening to the Ink and Paint Folk podcast, a look at animation through the women and non-binary folk who make it. I'm your host, Cassie Soliday. This is part two of my interview with Sabrina Cattuno. So if you haven't listened to part one yet, press pause and go take a listen. Still here? Great. On with part two.
So along the way of having a really busy day job working for these shows, were you developing your own ideas to go and pitch along the way? Or when was the moment that you knew that you wanted to like go and pitch and develop stuff?
I feel like it happened pretty gradually. Disney, at least, and I wouldn't be surprised if this is the case at other studios, it's not uncommon for development executives to, you know, just kind of reach out to new artists at the studio and just approach them and be like, hey, do you have anything to pitch? And it took a couple of years for me to actually have anything to pitch. Again, I'm very, very cautious by nature. I ended up developing a project over the course of two hiatuses between seasons of Star, largely just because, like, you know, that's the only time I really had time to draw seriously on my own. But also just because, like, I didn't know how to pitch. I didn't know how to put a good pitch together. And so I was very cautious about it. And I got, like, a lot of feedback before pitching it. And I developed that ultimately for about 2 years before I finally went back to that initial development executive and was like, let's schedule a pitch meeting.
Was that the idea that you ended up getting the overall deal with Disney, or did it take a few attempts?
I had no concept of what an overall deal was until I was put under one, to be honest.
What is it exactly? Can you like describe it? I haven't heard that term a lot.
Yeah. It's an overall deal is basically when a studio pays you to exclusively develop work for their studio. So if you hear that, like, you know, X person has an overall deal with Netflix or X person has an overall deal with Nickelodeon, it just means that they are kind of exclusively kind of chained to that studio, but they're being paid to develop, you know, ideas for that studio, or in some cases to help another person in development develop their ideas.
I see. And for you, you were doing it for your own creation.
Yes.
Cool. And I know that we can't go too much into that, but I was wondering if, like, for people who really dream about, you know, developing their own show and going through this process, is there anything that you would recommend to them?
I would recommend not spending 2.5 years developing it beforehand. That's too much time. I definitely could have gone a lot faster. I would say absolutely never sign a development deal without getting a lawyer first. That's really, really important, especially for young artists. I would always be a little bit wary of studios that are really eager to take pitches from very young or inexperienced artists. I know a lot of people are like really, really, you know, eager to become showrunners to get their own show. And it is possible, incidentally, to pitch when you're quite inexperienced, when you're very new to the studio system. You can get those meetings. I think it often surprises people like how easy it is. You know, a pitch meeting is literally just you have some materials, you know, a premise, some characters, some artwork, and you sit down at a table with someone and just like pitch it out verbally, explain what your story is. It's kind of that simple. So technically anybody can do it, but there are some things to watch out for if you're inexperienced. And, you know, like a studio can try and claim that story permanently, whether or not they produce it. Like they could take that story from you, or they could produce it and, you know, give the creative power to somebody else. They could hire a more experienced person to functionally run the show for you, and you're kind of a figurehead. That's happened to people. Or they could just really underpay you. You know, that's also happened. So, you know, if you ever get in the fortunate scenario where you pitch to an executive and they're like, we love this, we want it, you want to like pause and be like, great, I'm going to hire a lawyer and get back to you. You don't have to have a lawyer before that point. I certainly didn't. It's totally fine. But like, just keep that in the back of your head that, you know, you should have someone fighting in your corner who is more experienced, because otherwise, like, a single artist going up against, like, a giant studio is just, like, a very scary concept, and you just want to be able to protect yourself.
Do you think that if you hadn't worked for Disney, would you have been able to pitch to them without, like, an agent or manager?
That's a good question. I can't be sure, because that has been my only real experience pitching.
Yeah,
I'm actually not sure how easy it is. I mean, having said, you know, anyone can pitch, I'm not sure how easy it is if you don't have industry experience or some level of, like, credits to your name. I know it's happened. You might need a manager at that point, because sometimes I think Darren Nefcy had a manager before she had that much experience. I could be wrong. And I think that's how she got into pitch meetings initially. So yeah, generally you either want enough experience, people kind of know your name, or at least know your credits, or you want to sign with a manager who can get those meetings for you. I'm not sure if those are the only two ways, but those are the ways I'm familiar with.
Yeah, same here. Another thing that people don't always realize about development is that a lot of it is unpaid until they actually want to buy it. With the overall deal, I forgot if you had mentioned, like, were you going into the studio, like, every day as a full-time job, or did they, like, how did that work?
So I actually had, like, a two-part deal. The first one was, because I was scheduled to direct on the Owl House, I had a part-time deal where I would direct full-time, and then kind of in my free time, I would do my development work. To be honest, partially because I spent 2.5 years putting the damn thing together in the first place, I didn't actually have to do a huge amount of development work at the studio. I pretty much had it already done. So it was easy for me to do while I was working on something else. And in that instance, what would basically happen is I wasn't paid until I completed a chunk of work, say the Bible or, you know, like the pilot outline or, you know, a sample storyboard as a proof of concept. And I would be paid for those small chunks, but only once I completed those, you know, which with my working situation was totally fine. However, when I started the overall deal, that is when, you know, you get paid regardless, like a regular salary to develop. And there's drawbacks to both versions. Of course, you know, when you're not getting paid, that's its own drawback in and of itself. And especially if, you know, the process gets dragged out for years and years, which unfortunately can't happen at some studios. Some are more known for that than others. Where sometimes if a studio isn't paying for you, they're not very incentivized to follow up with you or to get back to you in a timely manner, which is extremely frustrating. I would say the downside of the overall deal is that if you get into a situation where, you know, another studio, you know, say, you know, the studio you're developing at says, you know, we're not actually interested in developing this, you know, we're not going to move forward, we're dropping the project. And you want to take it to another studio and be like, hey, could you develop this project instead? The first studio will make you pay for the entire amount that they paid you.
Wow.
And if they've been paying you a regular salary for a full year, that's going to be a lot of money, you know?
Yeah.
That's a lot of money. Like, and maybe they'll be able to negotiate down from it. They'll certainly claim that you owe them that money. So you have to pay it back in the end, one way or another.
That's so nuts. Jeez. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take this opportunity to jump to your webcomic, your personal project that you own completely. Your comic is called The Glass Scientists, an Edwardian tale. I've read the first issue and adore it. I think it's so much fun
far.
Could you pitch it to the audience?
Sure. The Glass Scientists is a steampunk-spiced webcomic about the life and times of a ragtag group of mad scientists trying to survive in an alternate Victorian London under the questionable guidance of their enigmatic leader, Dr. Henry Jekyll.
Very nice. That's such a perfect log line. I'm so sorry I called it Edwardian. Blaftorian.
Oh, that's fair. That's fine. Yeah, they're right next to each other.
And I wanted you to pitch it also so that we could hear you pitch something and Gosh, really good. Yeah. Very concise.
Thank you. Yeah, I think you get a little experience. I did conventions for a few years, and people will occasionally just ask you, like, oh, what's this about? And having, like, a one-line log line is so lovely.
Yeah, and there's so much, like, you use the word spice and ragtag team, and, like, there's so many fun words, and it really influences, like, how, like, for, like, personally, how I felt as you were describing it.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, like, where did this idea come about? Like, when did you start making this comic?
So it kind of started, honestly, back in high school. My friend Tori got me into the soundtrack for the musical Jekyll and Hyde, which is not the greatest musical in the world. It's basically kind of like discount Sweeney Todd. But it's about, you know, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, and I got super obsessed with it. And so I've always, you know, wanted to do something with, you know, the ideas I've had in my head for, you know, these characters in that story. And around the time that I was on Gravity Falls, after working there for a few months, it did kind of sink in that, you know, like, this is a great show to work on for sure. But, you know, I really miss getting to write my own stories. You know, I miss, you know, that CalArts feeling, like feeling in control of the entire process. And also previously, when I found out at Disney Feature that they were like, oh, you're not actually good enough to be in story. I was just like, oh, this really sucks. How do I get good at being at story? So just as kind of like an exercise for myself, I just started writing an outline for the story that I had in my head about Jekyll and Hyde. And so every day I'd come home and like write, you know, another paragraph of like, here's another scene that's going to happen. And, you know, I wrote it all down scene by scene until I had a full outline. And then I went back and kind of rewrote the whole thing for a second draft. And, you know, by the time I was ready to start the comic, I kind of had the outline for the Glass Scientists planned out in my head. And also I want to mention, sorry, there's so many things that start off like being in this comic. Mm-hmm. Also, you know, you always hear, you know, if you're going to start doing comics, start with something short. So I decided to create a short prequel comic to The Glass Scientist called Bleeding Heart, which I decided to kickstart. And that was actually super, super fun. The Kickstarter went rather well.
And that's available on Gumroad right now, right?
Yeah, it's on Gumroad. Or you can also get on Store Envy. Like the physical copies are still there. Oh, cool. That was a super fun experience. And, you know, based off that, just kind of launched into the comic a couple months later.
During all this time, I can't believe that you were having this day job and working on this comic. Like, it is so well drawn, beautifully colored.
Oh, thank you.
And like, that's a lot of work, like, period. So much work to put together a webcomic, particularly a graphic novel, pages, multiple.
The full color panels. Aspect is a real... It's a real kicker.
Yeah, and you had a collaborator, right?
Functionally, I have a color assistant who kind of handles like character flats, putting in the shadows, etc. I think I've gotten more involved in kind of like handling more and more of the color work as the story has gone on. You know, as I'm ideally trying to hand off more work to my assistant, so I'm not quite as bogged down with everything. Actually, now they also handle some of the background inks as well, which is really nice. But, you know, all the stuff up until that point it's all me just working, you know, nights and weekends.
Okay, so two questions from what you just said. First, mm-hmm. How did you keep the passion and motivation to keep going at it? Like, you have so many chapters already finished.
Oh my goodness.
You've been doing it for years. Like, how?
Yo, it's all about a schedule and a routine, honestly. There have definitely been points where just kind of like, I can't do this anymore. I'm going to quit, you know, within a couple of months if it doesn't get better. But I'm just very naturally schedule and routine oriented. And so, you know, just one page at a time, just focus on getting that one page out and doing the best you can on it. And, you know, eventually the momentum kind of gets you through. And before you know it, you've been doing it for 5 years. Also, I've always kind of thought like, I just want one thing that's mine, that's in the world, that isn't attached to, you know, some other creator. And so, like, my intention is to keep doing it until someone else gets me something else to make, you know?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so my second question is, like, when you're looking for... I mean, it sounds like you've been working with your assistant for a while now, but, like, in general, when you're looking for collaborators, like, what do you look for?
So I should actually clarify. I've had two colorists over the course of the comic. I had Tina Purin, who worked through chapters 1 through 8, I believe. And then when I decided I wanted to kind of expand the duties, she decided to, you know, bow out and focus on her personal work. And then I brought in Velo, who was my colorist until the present day. So hiring is still a big question mark for me. I don't know. I just do like mini tests, to be honest. I have like, you know, here's a panel, color it, you know, for daytime and nighttime. And I just kind of like, we'll look for, you know, how they're handling detail and just kind of like, we'll try and judge as much from as little test work as possible. Cause of course in animation, there's this big conversation about, you know, testing and, you know, requiring unpaid labor incidentally for the second round of testing. I did pay for each test. But
which
no,
all
I still,
studios should do, by the way.
Yes. Yes. I did a paid test. But I still try to keep it kind of as short as possible. Cause I feel like it doesn't take a huge amount of time to actually assess. Certainly I feel like for like visual development, like for art side and you know, what the skill level is and how well they're able to match a style, from a single panel or maybe two panels in different lighting conditions. Mm-hmm. So I was just, you know, trying to see who could match the style, while also causing them as little extra work as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's great. I think if people could manage it, delegating is such a powerful tool to get more done and to make all the mm-hmm. projects you want.
Oh, yeah.
Because you're a creator and, you know, create your own stories and, you know, design characters and everything, I'm wondering how you feel about representation. Like, how do you, even when boarding or directing, like, how do you bring inclusion into the project you're doing?
That is a whole huge conversation. It's something that I care about a lot. I feel like so we've seen like a huge evolution in the conversation about representation for LGBT characters in particular. I think since I began, it really, again, this is just my personal impression. I feel like when I first started working professionally, it just wasn't a subject that was brought up. I remember telling my friend back in like 2011, because they were like, oh, you know, if my story ever got adapted, it's so important to me that my main character, you know, be allowed to be gay. And I just kind of laughed at them. And I was like, that's never going to happen. But, you know, as it happened, around 2012, I came out as bi after like, what, like 22 years of like being super in denial about it. And I started to get very, very frustrated at like seeing that like only straight characters got to have romance stories in animation. And the thing is, I actually really don't like romance that much in general. I find it kind of tedious and boring. For me, the only thing that can spice it up is if it's super gay. And so, you know, kind of resigning myself to being in this industry where I was, you know, frankly, as you know, as a female presenting person, kind of expected to kind of take on more emotional and romance focused aspects of, you know, the storytelling, that like, if I'm going to be resigned to this, at the very least, I don't want to be doing, you know, straight stories, you know, this entire time. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of started a long crusade of trying to get this conversation started at the studio I was working at, to, I would say like very, very mixed results, but I kept trying. and the funny thing has been watching this conversation evolve over the past, you know, 5 years or so, and having it be such, I feel like, a really open topic nowadays. And now studios are very, very open. Like, oh, we want LGBT characters. I feel like what has been lost a little bit is the fact like, hey, you know how you guys are so eager to have LGBT characters because there aren't any? The reason there aren't any is because 5 years ago, you were completely banning this stuff. And I wish there was more acknowledgement about like, hey, very, very, until very, very recently, like we were preventing this stuff from going through, you know, like just to acknowledge that, just like to acknowledge, you know, their part in the silencing of these voices in the past. And now I think a lot of people are getting accolades for being progressive, for having these LGBT characters. And it can be a little frustrating at times knowing that like these were the same studios who were actively, almost actively isn't even the word for it. Like, it was just kind of shadow banned, where they understood that, like, it'll look really bad if we say we don't like the gays, but we don't want any gays, you know? Mm-hmm. We're in a much better place overall, but, you know, I think we still have a long way to go. And I think it would be very helpful if we kind of acknowledged the history of, you know, the censorship that's going on in studios, just straight up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it kind of feels like in some instances, the studios, at least on social media, like they're just like waking up to it, mm-hmm. when, of course, they've been faced with it before, and people trying to make change within the structure of the mm-hmm. corporation, right? I looked up a few days ago, GLAAD has an annual report on LGBTQ inclusion in media, not animation mm-hmm. specifically, but mm-hmm. the report I found was from 2017 to 18, and I just wanted to share some of these percentages. Mm-hmm. They say a diversity of regular characters on primetime scripted broadcast television was about 93.7% straight and 6.4% mm-hmm. LGBTQ. And I feel like we could probably assume that in animation, there's even less, you know?
Quite a bit less, I'd say.
Because, yeah. like, we kind of take their genders just at, like, how they present, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But this other a graph I wanted to share about sexual orientation of LGBTQ characters on streaming, just within that group of people, like, mm-hmm. 36 of them are usually lesbian, 24% mm-hmm. gay, 33% mm-hmm. bisexual, 6% mm-hmm. straight, 1% asexual, and 1% undetermined. Yeah, mm-hmm. so I found that really interesting, and it seems like Netflix is really kind of leading the way in terms.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
As a creator, and as someone who fits into this, you know, group of people, does that make you, like, want to go kind of, like, pitch to certain companies rather than others, knowing their, like, background on the subject?
You know, it's funny. I think, I feel like at the present moment, like, studios are fairly hungry for diversity. And they like the idea of, like, authentic perspectives, you know, telling diverse stories. I would be a lot more comfortable sharing, you know, LGBT stories, LGBT characters than I would have been when I first started pitching. I think the slight danger is, you know, they want all these authentic perspectives, but, you know, I feel like asking creators to kind of, like, put all their personal history, all of their trauma and, you know, really personal stuff out in front of people and use it as a selling point, it's a little exhausting, you know? Like, I've been encouraged so many times, you know, put your, you know, Japanese American heritage front and center, put your, you know, sexual orientation front and center. It feels like you're being asked to pitch naked, you know?
Mm.
And it's been like, you know, straight white guys don't have to, you know, tear out their heart and slap it on the table and be like, judge me, judge my heart. Is it good? Is it not? You know? Whereas I feel like, you know, if you're in a minority, there's this expectation, you know, you really want to, you know, use your identity and, you know, sell it. Maybe I don't want to sell myself, you know, like maybe things shouldn't be monetized in that way. And, you know, on the one hand, I'm really glad we're in this moment where, like, people value diversity. I'm skeptical for how long it will stick around. I feel like these things kind of tend to be cyclical, where, like, occasionally studios will just kind of wake up and be like, oh my God, non-white people exist. Oh, shoot, we need to cater to them. And they'll just kind of fall asleep after a certain point. I feel like we're going to eventually see that again. I feel like as someone who's gone through the system, you know, being very much encouraged by executives to pitch identity first, it makes you very vulnerable, you know, kind of both emotionally and just, like, from a professional point of view, where, like, one day they could say, we want, you know, a lesbian character. You know, you're a lesbian, authentic perspective. We love it. But then if they say, you know, they turn around the next day and be like, oh, actually, we don't want it. It feels much more personal when that rejection hits, you know, because, like, suddenly now, if you've been encouraged to put your entire identity into your show, what they're basically saying is, like, we don't want your identity, you know, and, like, I feel like that's very emotionally hard. And I wish there was a way for students to acknowledge that, like, we're kind of expecting minority people to put on a performance for us and to take on a lot of emotional labor to educate often straight white executives about their experience. And we don't place that burden on straight white, you know, male showrunners.
Mm-hmm. That's totally true. And I've heard that when minority folks do get into like executive producer roles, like if they sell the show and it goes, like mm-hmm. They get paired with more experienced showrunners who are typically white and male.
Experience means older white and male.
Yeah.
Almost across the board. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have not personally experienced that yet, but yes, I have seen that. Again, like I said, that's another thing you want to watch out for. You know, that's a good thing to have a lawyer or a manager for if you ever get in the position of negotiating for your contract for developing for showrunning, because you can accidentally sign those rights away to essentially sign, you know, your power and your voice away. And it's just something to keep in mind. You know, it's something you can fight for, but just, you know, be careful what you sign, mm-hmm. you know?
How do you suggest, because like I can imagine, especially if it's like the first project, the first deal that a person is making, they might feel like they mm-hmm. can't speak up for what they want. What advice would you give them to like gather the confidence to ask for what they mm-hmm. want, even though they could lose this deal?
The simple answer is you should not be the one speaking up. You need to hire a lawyer 100% of the time.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, unless you yourself have executive experience at that studio, the thing is that the executive has so much more information than you do. You are kind of speaking to a black box. You don't know what numbers they're looking at. You don't know what they're looking for. You have no idea what they've seen before. They just have information they just will not have access to, you know? Mm. And so it's not something, you just shouldn't go in there alone. And you let someone else deal with it for you, they get to be the bad guy. You get to look like, oh, the nice creator. You want to, you know, you want to play nice. You want to be, you get to be the person who has, you know, the smiling face talking to the executives. And then your lawyer gets to fight for you, you know?
Mm-hmm. On representation still, like mm-hmm. how can people be an ally in the workplace?
You know, speaking up, man, you know, if you see something in a script, if you hear something in a meeting that sounds bad, you know, don't force the poor, you know, minority person to be the one who has to advocate for themselves. It's so helpful if you have someone else in the room who just speaks up, because that's so much of why, you know, bad things get to the screen, is that like no one had the guts to say like, hey, this really isn't cool. And, you know, just to if you know, you have a colleague who feels, you know, that something in at the workplace is making them uncomfortable, you know, listen to them and, you know, help them speak up for themselves. And just, you know, it's really all just about, you know, lending your voice to the conversation.
Yeah. Wonderful. So moving on to self-care, you mentioned earlier, like you're very routine oriented and mm-hmm. you schedule yourself out so that you can get everything done that you want to get done. Do you schedule in a work-life balance or are you constantly working? Do you have friends outside?
I could have a better work-life balance. And like, look, who has friends now? It's COVID.
That's true.
You know, like I'm so tired of Zoom lunches. Like I don't socialize very easily over video chat. So that's definitely been a struggle. I feel like lunches were always a good time to grab lunch with people. At least, you know, on the first few productions I was on, you know, had a pretty good social circle, and could, you know, hang out with people on coffee breaks or at lunch. So a lot of times, you know, my social circle came from work, during the overall deal. Just when you're developing by yourself, that is by nature, like a little more isolating. So I would kind of more consciously schedule out hanging out with friends or grabbing dinner or something. You know, my comic did keep me busy, but I would usually have like a couple nights a week where I wasn't working at all. And I would always kind of try and make time for socializing when I could. I'm not the most social person just by nature. I'm pretty introverted. So I think if I'm socializing too long, I would get like antsy to go back to work. Mm-hmm. So I don't require a huge amount of outside activities. And that's kind of a family trait. My family doesn't have hobbies. They basically work and then outside of work, they talk about work. I'm not sure if that's super healthy, but that's just kind of like, that's my upbringing. It's not just the industry. That's just kind of how I was raised and what I'm used to. Mm-hmm. But yeah, yeah.
It's good to know that about yourself, though. Like, are you intentional about, like, self-care? I mean, having a few nights a week, you know, off, like you mentioned, that's good.
I definitely am very serious about getting enough sleep. I just cannot function under less than ideal sleep situations. And also, I dealt with, like, really bad insomnia when I was at the Pixar internship. And so, like, that is the thing I'm always afraid of falling back into. So I always try and get 8 hours of sleep as much as possible. I have a slightly unusual insomnia prevention routine. I feel like, you know, a lot of people, you know, if they have insomnia, they'll engage in, like, you know, good sleep hygiene routines, like, you know, like no screens in the bedroom, you know, having a bedtime ritual, you know, just kind of like clearing their minds thoughtfully before going to bed. I kind of weirdly do the opposite. I neg insomnia because I think for whatever reason, my anxiety is set off by the knowledge that, like, I'm afraid of not being able to sleep. And it'll be like, oh, you're trying to have, like, sleep hygiene. You're trying to take good care of yourself. Well, screw you. Now I'm going to make it even harder for you to sleep. So I have a weird thing where, like, if I have an insomnia night, I do self-care the day after rather than trying to prevent it the night before, where I just kind of like, it's just an insomnia night, just have to accept it and tell my brain that, like, I don't care if I don't sleep, that's totally fine, I'm not gonna freak out about this, and then just, like, try and take care of myself and be kind to myself the next day, or until the insomnia goes away. And that, for whatever reason, helps better than having a sleep routine. I don't know how common that is, but that's just, like, how I deal with it.
Yeah. Very interesting. I also get insomnia, and I've tried some of those, like, trying to avoid it routines, but I think I end up pretty much doing what you do as well. And of course, drinking tons of coffee the next day to stay awake.
Yeah.
I was thinking about this when I was, like, preparing to talk to you tonight, because, like, when I first met you, it was in a group setting, and I was like, oh my gosh, they're so confident. It was kind of, like, jarring to me.
Oh, really? I sounded confident?
Yeah, you were, like, super confident. And I feel like probably having a good representation of yourself in your mind, the person you want to be, is probably a way of self-care as well. Like as you've been going through your journey, like, have you had a vision of the person you've wanted to be?
No, that's a super interesting question, actually. Honestly, I'm not sure I have a good idea of who I want to be or what my goal is. I think I tend to be, like, there are certain situations where I think I'm pretty decent at projecting confidence. One is, you know, in, like, a convention situation where, like, I have a set things to say, and I just know if I just memorize those things, and, you know, like, with the log line for the glass scientist, I can just rattle that off in any situation and sound, like, decently confident about it because, like, I've just practiced it so much. I've just done the Michael Phelps thing of, like, imagining the swim over and over and over again so that when it actually happens, it's, like, it bypasses the thingy part of your brain, just goes to, like, the limbic system.
I love that.
So that's one thing. Another thing is that, like, for whatever reason, a minor superpower I have is that I don't have much stage fright. I'm the sort of person where, like, I grew up around, like, very, very confident, assertive people. My parents are both lawyers. And it was always a struggle to, you know, to speak, I think, because number one, they're talking so much, it's hard to get a word in. And number two, when you do talk, they cross-examine you. And so, like, for me, when anyone gives me an opportunity to speak freely without the fear that they're going to pick apart every single word that you're saying, I'm just so delighted to be able to speak that, like, I think it comes out appearing as confidence. And also, for me, I think, you know, at this group we're both a part of, you know, part of it is kind of a career support group. I love getting to talk about my weaknesses. It is my favorite subject. And I think that's, like, a weird, like, getting over shame kind of tactic, where, like, to me, what really increases feelings of shame is silence, you know, and this feeling that like we shouldn't talk about it. That makes me feel so terrible. If, you know, if something has happened to me that's so horrible that, you know, everyone just feels bad for me. They feel pity for me and they don't even want to mention it because it'll make me feel so bad. That's so disempowering. That makes me feel so awful. And so like my antidote to that is, you know, kind of like when I didn't get the job at the Disney training program, is just be like, hey guys, I'm a huge mess. Here's what's happening. Here's why I'm sad. And like, I just try to be super honest and like open about my feelings, especially frankly, you know, if they're negative feelings, because like, that's kind of my way of taking back a little bit of power from the shame and the silence. And obviously like there's a way to do that in a way that is super, super manipulative and, you know, like radical honesty can be like very much a bad thing. And I try not to do that. But I just feel like for me, you know, if I let emotions fester, I'm going to be a huge grouch to be around. So I'd rather just like get it out in the open, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I try to live.
I love that. Thank you for sharing that.
Of course, yeah.
I'm definitely going to be re-listening to this interview so many times just to hear that over and over. Now we're to the part of the episode where we celebrate others. Mm-hmm. Is there anyone we should check out that you're really into?
Does it have to be animation specifically?
No, it could be any kind of creative, mm-hmm. anything in general.
Oh, goodness. I'll try and give like one animation and then like one non-animation.
That'd be
great. gosh, I'm not sure if this like counts. It's not like a specific artist, but are you guys familiar with a Rise Up animation?
Yes.
Okay, so you guys already know about the one, so I won't go hash.
Oh, I mean, you could share it. Are you mentoring with them?
Yeah. I mean, I'm taking a break right now just like I'm super, super busy and just don't have time to take on more than I currently have. But the work they're doing is like super, super great. I feel like it's great praxis. You know, I feel like after the Black Lives Matter protest, kind of all those conversations just kind of faded away. But, you know, they're still going. Like, they are going strong and like keeping with their mission, which I think is really, really wonderful. I do want to like briefly geek out about a book I just read.
Please, let's go.
I just finished Spinning Silver by Naomi Novik. It was a very historically grounded fantasy book, but it is just like such a delightful, simultaneously like, it's very much a good fantasy escape, but also feels very, you know, relevant. It talks, you know, it deals a lot with, you know, how oppressed people in society kind of like go through the world and how they deal with it. At the same time, it also has not one but two sexy, bitchy ice princes who are beautiful and horrible and just a delight on every single page. So it was super, super fun. It really lifted my spirits. If you like fantasy and beautiful, horrible men, you should definitely read it.
I have it on my to read list now. Just added it.
You know, I always try and kind of brush up on my figure drawing skills. And I feel like I am certainly not aware of anyone who is like more inspirational from a gesture drawing point of view than Natalie Norgett, mm-hmm. at Disney Feature.
Yeah, definitely. And during COVID, she's been, I think, hosting some like figure drawing over Instagram sessions, right? Like, yeah. Her and a bunch of other folks. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's pretty neat. Yes. What do you think is your like favorite animated movie or show, or one of them? I know it could differ per day.
I have to admit, I'm one of those people who like works in animation but doesn't watch a lot of animation. Especially, I don't watch a lot of animated TV, in particular. So I kind of tend to go outside of the American industry just because, like, I work there. I don't necessarily need to spend all my time, you know, working within, watching things that work within the same restrictions that I have to work within. So I really love Agretzko.
Oh,
you
yeah.
know,
mm-hmm.
It's just so, it's so relevant. It's so good. It's so cathartic. I love it to bits. What else have I watched that's animated? Oh my God. I'm one of those horrible people who doesn't watch animation.
Well, tell me anything like live action.
I'm so sorry. I'm just trying to think like, what do I What did I watch?
It's okay. We could skip it. I actually really think it's cool that you go outside of animation. I feel like there's a lot of people who do that. Like, they don't watch what's animated things these days, you know, particularly TV. Sometimes they'll go see the movies, but usually they aren't, they don't really know what's going on in the TV world unless their friends work on it.
Yeah, it's so funny. Like, it really, you do end up watching things that your friends work on, mostly because your friends work on them. And I think part of it is kind of like, you know, there's so much media out there nowadays. And I think that may be, you know, a harbinger of worse things to come for the industry of just like, you know, we're in a bit of a content overload right now. And so if you're going to watch something, it better be worth your time. Like, I will, like, for me, it's almost more of a chore to get through a series, honestly. I feel like I either breeze through something or I just don't start at all, you know, just because there's so much to watch.
That does mean that there's more jobs though, which is exciting. But do you think, because I've been thinking about this lately, I worry that like the bubble's going to burst and then animated projects will kind of go back down to, you know, smaller numbers. And then there's all these professionals out of work, you know.
I'm incredibly worried about that. And like, I feel like we're almost like tempting fate by like all the rhetoric of like, you know, animation is really flourishing during the pandemic. And, you know, so many other industries are really struggling, but we're doing great. I feel like we're just like inciting some horrible thing to come. Yeah. And that's very more, but it's just what it feels like, you know. It's like, it feels weird that we haven't suffered as much as other industries. And I feel like there's a reckoning somewhere. That doesn't make sense logically. It's just what it feels like, you know?
I also think it's just slightly rude to be like, have you asked like the animation professionals working on those shows? Like, is it flourishing for them? Because like, we're all super stressed out and, you know, there's parents who are juggling like multiple things.
Yeah, like, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
So yeah. Final advice for creative folks who want to do what you do.
You know, I think especially when you're trying to break in, you know, try and, you know, keep a routine. Don't give up applying to places. Don't give up testing for places. But also give yourself room to feel bad. Honestly, trying to break in is probably the hardest part of working in the industry. It's hard for everybody. You know, it's hard for different people in different ways at times. But like, if you're feeling bad when you're trying to break in, that's normal. You know, in the same way that, you know, like if you're feeling stressed out because it's COVID, that's normal. It would be weirder if you weren't feeling bad, you know, when you're trying to break into the industry. It'd be weirder if you weren't stressed out. That is a normal state of things. And you shouldn't feel bad about feeling bad in this space, you know. But as long, like, give yourself time to feel your feelings as long as you save enough energy to keep going, you know, don't beat yourself up for feeling bad.
I love that. Such great advice. Where can people find you online?
You can find me on my Twitter, which is Arithusa, spelled A-R-Y-T-H-U-S-A, at my portfolio website, www.cgoatrun.com. Don't ask what that means. It was a weird joke when I was 14.
Okay, because I was going to ask about it.
14-year-old sense of humor, or at theglassscientists.com. That's scientists, plural.
Very cool. Thank you so much, Sabrina, for coming on the show. This has been an amazing conversation.
Of course. Thank you so much.
Ink and Paint Folk is produced in partnership with Women in Animation, an organization dedicated to advancing women in the field of animation and reaching 50-50 by the year 2025. Learn more at womeninanimation.org. Please also check out other great organizations promoting diversity in the industry: Black and Animated, Rise Up Animation, and Latinx in Animation. This episode was produced by me in beautiful Burbank, California. Music by Grace Saw and TV's Kyle. edited by Mae Murphy. All opinions expressed here are our own and do not represent those of our respective employers. Until next time, this has been the Ink and Paint Folk Podcast. Stay colorful.